Let's go back to Exodus 20 again. As we finished out the Ten Commandments, now we're coming into another section of the law. And this we'll call the judgment. This is the judgment section. It'll deal with case law, as we call it in our legal system. But remember, as we outlined the law when we first started Exodus, it breaks down into three parts. The first part is the commandments. And the commandments talk about Israel's moral life. And God says your moral life is to be dictated by me and only me. Israel's moral life is dictated by the law. And that was chapter 19 and 20. Remember, chapter 19 was the prelude to the Ten Commandments, and then chapter 20 is the Ten Commandments. We haven't finished it yet, but I'm rounding off the chapters here. The judgments will come next in chapters 21 through 23. Now, this is going to talk about Israel's civil life. Not so much moral, but civil. This would be our civil law, as we call it, or case law. Exodus 21 to 23. Then we'll have the ordinances. And the ordinances deal with Israel's religious life. And it also is governed by God. And that'll be Exodus 24 through the book of Leviticus. So, we have those three parts of the law. The moral part, the civil part, and the religious part. And God determines all three of those, morality, civility, and religiosity. If we take all the laws, all three of those groups, we can break them down into two different kinds of laws. There are two different kinds, two basic types of law. The first is the conditional form. And that's what we'll be coming up to in chapter 21. Generally, in a conditional form, you'll see the main condition introduced by the word if. If somebody does this, then this is what happens. And additional subheadings can go under that, and they start with if as well. So it's if somebody does this, this is what happens. And if he does this, this is what happens. So that's the conditional kind of law. That's what we would call case law in our legal system. It's called casuistic law. It's from the Latin word for case. That's why it has that name. What it means is it's a law based on actual precedents. Like say if somebody kills somebody else's ox, well, that probably happened. You know, there are precedents. And God is going to say this is what will happen. So that's casuistic laws. You don't have to remember those words. They're the words the scholars use, but I just mention them in case you run across them, you'll know what they mean. The next type of law is a categorical, unconditional form. It's not an if. There's no ifs, ands, or buts involved in this. It's either a command or a prohibition. Either do this, don't do that. And it has no ifs or thens associated with it. This is the form we've just been looking at in the Ten Commandments, isn't it? It says, you shall not murder. Doesn't say if. It says you shall not murder. That's a moral absolute. Now we get into case law. It'll say if you kill somebody, then certain things are going to take place. And if you kill somebody illegally, criminally, you will be put to death. So that's the case law side. Many of the case laws or the judgments that we see are a result of the Ten Commandments. They're just the outworking of the Ten Commandments. Because we have a commandment, you shall not murder. So the case law is, if you murder somebody, this is what's going to happen. So that's God telling Israel what its civil law should entail. This is called the apodictic type of law, or apodictic. It depends on who you ask. And it's kind of funny because I use a word processor called Malel. Probably most people don't use that. But I do the bulletins in Microsoft Word. Malel tells me this is wrong and apodictic is right when I do the spell check. And Word tells me apodictic is right and this is wrong. So take your pick. It can be spelled either way. Actually, apodictic makes more sense because it's from the Greek word apodeictikos. And what that means is capable of demonstration. So this is an unconditional command, just like the Ten Commandments. You shall not kill. Those two types. So we got three sets and two types, okay? We need to keep that in mind as we go through the law. And we'll look at the prologue, and that's where the last part of chapter 20 comes in. In verse 22 through 26, we have a prologue to the judgments. And what it is, basically, is it's connected to the Ten Commandments because verses 22 and 23 repeat the same subject that we had in verses 3 through 6, but they add a little bit to it. So it's just kind of an additional information type of thing. In 22, it says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make other gods besides me, the gods of silver or gods of gold. You shall not make for yourselves. You shall make an altar of earth for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen in every place where I cause my name to be remembered. I will come to you and bless you. If you make an altar of stone for me, you shall not build it of cut stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you will profane it. And you shall not go up by steps to my altar, so that your nakedness will not be exposed on it.'" So that's pretty much what the commandments have said. No other gods before me, no idols. And now he adds that you're going to have an altar. And the ones he talks about here are very simple earthen altars. You shall make an altar of earth or of rocks. Can't be cut with a tool, but they have to be rocks. And what he's getting down here basically is simply this. You all witnessed the Lord speaking from heaven. And he says that in verse 22, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven.'" Now, when God spoke to Israel from heaven, they all heard it. They all knew it. But they couldn't see God because God was in the cloud, remember? So they couldn't see God. So they witnessed God speaking, and there was no physical representation whatsoever. Now, that was very unusual in those days because they all had idols to worship. They wanted to put a face on their God, so to speak. So they'd make an idol that was supposed to represent him. God says, "You heard me talk out of a cloud. You didn't see anything concrete, anything physical. Therefore, forget any thought of trying to embody me in a material image." And that goes along with the command against idols. You shall not worship idols. And you shall not worship, even if you say that they represent me, it's wrong because you heard me talk and there wasn't any representation physically. Now, when Moses goes up to the mountain, what do? They build a golden calf. What do they say about that golden calf? "This is the God who led us out of Egypt." So what are they saying? This is a true God, but they made an image to worship. And that was wrong. They don't need a physical image. Nor do we. We don't have a physical, there's no crucifixes or anything that we need to see to worship God. We don't have to. We worship God by applying worth to His Word. And that's what we do when we study His Word. And that's why we study His Word. So, a repetition of what He said before, but with a little more detail added. And we have the altars. They're temporary in form so far. This is going to be, the tabernacle will come a little later, and then the temple. But for right now, it's just earthen altars. Stone altars couldn't be cut with a tool. And no stairs were allowed. This one's kind of interesting. That no stairs were allowed to avoid exposing nakedness. And what does that mean? Well, I take it that the Hebrews and wearing their robes, priests wearing their robes, went commando, if you know what I mean. And somebody was at the bottom of the stairs, and the priest was up the stairs. It might be a little embarrassing. So God made the rule: no stairs. I don't want anybody down at the bottom peeking up the stairs to see what's under the priest's robe. Basically, it's interesting because later on, God allowed stairs to the altar. You know, the temple had steps, and he allowed that, but he added an instruction for the priests to wear underwear. So it's kind of interesting. Here we have no stairs because I don't want anybody peeking up anybody's robes, but when you get to the point where you can have stairs, then you have to have linen undergarments. So I know that's all too much information, but it just struck me as interesting when I was reading through it this week. So let's look at the judgments now. And remember, this is case law now. It's based on the Ten Commandments, and it's the case law that proceeds from the Ten Commandments. And the first one concerns masters and servants. That's in chapter 21, verse 1 through 11. Chapter 21 says, "Now these are the ordinances which you are to set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years. But on the seventh, he shall go out as a free man without payment. If he comes alone, he shall go out alone. If he is the husband of a wife, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall belong to her master, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, 'I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man,' then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of her master, who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He does not have authority to sell her to a foreign people because of his unfairness to her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. If he will not do these things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money." So the first thing to remember in the Jewish master-slave law system is that there was no such thing as involuntary permanent slavery in Egypt. They didn't have slaves that they owned forever. In fact, if a person became so destitute that he couldn't survive, he would sell himself to someone else, and as it says here, He's to be set free after a certain period of time, and he's to be compensated for his work. So there was no permanent slavery. In Exodus 21:2, if you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. And the words without payment means he doesn't have to buy his freedom. Now in the Roman Empire, a slave could buy himself. Well, he couldn't actually buy himself. He had to go sell himself to a temple and then he would be released. It was kind of just a legal matter there. But he could pay and be released from slavery. In Israel, he was to leave without having to pay anything. So slaves were to be freed in the year of Jubilee, no matter how long they served. And here in verse 2, it says, if you buy a Hebrew slave, and he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man. But on the year of Jubilee, all the slaves were released. And that's in Leviticus chapter 25. In Leviticus 25, we have more elaboration of the slave master laws. And in verse 39, it says, if a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to you that he sells himself to you, you shall not subject him to a slave service. He shall be with you as a hired man, as if he were a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. He shall then go out from you, he and his sons with him, and shall go back to his family that he may return to the property of his forefathers. So in the year of Jubilee, all slaves were released. In Leviticus 25:10, it tells us what the Jubilee is, if you were wondering. Verse 10 says, you shall thus consecrate the 50th year and proclaim a release through the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his own property, and each of you shall return to his own family. So every 50th year, they would have a jubilee year, and the slaves would be released. Now the word jubilee is the Hebrew word yovel, and yovel means ram's horn. Now, how do we get from ram's horn to jubilee? Well, a ram's horn, you know, they use as a musical instrument. They blow through it. That's how they announced the Jubilee year. On the Day of Atonement, they would blow on ram's horns, and that would announce that this is the year of Jubilee. So slaves are to be released. It was celebrated every 50th year, or every 49th year, depends on who you talk to. And there was a consideration of individual cases. So we're back in the slave case law now, back to Leviticus chapter 21, and we see that not only is there not permanent slavery, but there were individual cases. And that's in Exodus 21, 3 to 6, and that tells that, you know, if he comes alone, he'll go out alone. But if he already has a wife when he comes, then his wife and kids go with him. But if he comes and his master gives him a wife and she has kids, then they belong to the master, of course, until Jubilee, and then they're all released. So that's how there are individual cases involved. And there was to be a generous provision provided for a released slave. He was to be paid for his work. And that's back in Deuteronomy 15, or at Deuteronomy 15. In verse 12 through 15. Verse 12 says, if your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year you shall set him free. And that's like we said before. When you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally from your flock and from your threshing floor, from your wine vat. You shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. So there wasn't a specific amount. It was, if you're a rich person, you would give him a lot. If you're a poor person, you would give him a little. But the idea is no work is to go unpaid. That idea is throughout the whole entire Bible. If somebody does work for you, then you pay that person. Even the slaves. This guy was too poor. He had to sell himself to his neighbor. But when his period of slavery, that seventh year came along, was ended, then he was to be released. And not only be released, he was to be paid for the work he had done. So, the slave, being a slave wasn't as bad as it might sound. Interesting note, that last part where if the slave says, I love my master, then there was a ceremony performed and he became a permanent slave. And that ceremony of the slave is shown by Jesus and his father. Look up at Exodus 21, we just read 5 and 6. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, now that's not to be taken in the sense of romantic love, but in the sense of choosing. I choose to stay with my master. I don't want to leave him. I like him. He's too good of a master. Remember the Apostle Paul, he called himself a slave of Christ all the time. He was a willing slave. He loved his master, so he wanted to stay a slave. Hebrews 10, look up at Hebrews 10, and it links Jesus and God the Father in this same manner. It's kind of an interesting parallel that in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 5, it says, therefore, when he comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. So Jesus is coming. Jesus came. He became a man. God didn't want the blood of sheep and goats. That was not sufficient payment for sin. So he prepared a body for his son. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book, it is written of me to do your will, O God. So Jesus is saying, I am a willing slave. I love my master so much that I want to be a slave. Now back to Exodus 21. And we'll go to our next case. And that's the case of a girl who is sold by her father into slavery. Now, that was done for marriage, not for a upstairs maid. It was done for marriage. They sold their daughter to somebody else to be his wife or his son's wife, as we saw in the context. So there's provision for that. And if the terms of the marriage are not fulfilled, it's considered to be a breach of contract. So if a guy buys a girl to be his wife and then decides he doesn't like her, he can't sell her to a foreigner. That's what verse 7. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave, she is not to go free as the male slaves do. If she is displeasing in the eyes of the master who designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. In other words, he has to let the father buy her back. He does not have the authority to sell her off to somebody else. He has to let her be redeemed because that's talking about a wife and not just a household slave. So she must always be treated. And, you know, people say the Bible, all it does is it tells women that they need to be barefoot and pregnant all the time. That's not so. The Bible stands up for the rights of women in a time when they had no rights. But if a father sold a daughter as a slave, as a wife to someone, he had responsibilities. He had to either treat her as a wife, a daughter, or a free woman. He couldn't do anything else. So she had equality under the law. And no other culture had this. I mean, the Bible was telling women they had rights way back before there ever was a woman's rights movement. And it's very clear here. Verse 9 says, if he designates her for a son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. So if he marries her, he's to treat her as a wife. If his son marries her, he's to treat her as a daughter. But if they can't do any of those things, down in verse 11, it says, if he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. So she's treated as a free woman. She's either a daughter, a wife, or a free woman. You know, the slave was treated, and this went for all slaves, they were treated as part of the family unit. They were part of the family. The slavery we had in Israel was nothing at all like the slavery they suffered in Egypt. They suffered terrible mistreatment in Egypt. Under Hebrew law, God's law, a slave had rights. And we'll see a little more of that too as we move along here. Regulations concerning homicide in verse 12 through 17. Verse 12 says, he who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hands, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar, that he may die. If he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. He who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. Verse 12 through 14 talk about death penalty, as do the one about 15 and 17. So, murder, striking a parent, kidnapping, or cursing a parent were capital offenses. Those were the capital offenses in the Mosaic law. First we have murder. And murder, it's very simple, isn't it? In verse 12, he who strikes a man that he dies shall surely be put to death. If you kill someone criminally, it's the death penalty. Why is that? Look back at Genesis chapter 9. Why is life so important anyway? You know, the guy was a bum. He didn't. Why is it so important? And we'll notice there's no social status, wealth, anything like that associated with this. It's anybody who murders somebody else shall be put to death. Very simple. In Genesis 9:6, it says, whoever sheds a man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. That's the reason. Man is made in the image of God, even unbelievers, even nasty unbelievers. So if you murder them outside of the law, then it's the death penalty. Very simple. Since men or women are made in the image of God, then no money, no property settlement can atone for a murder because they bear the image of God. Accidental death is another story. That's distinguished. And we see that back in Exodus. In chapter 1, verse 13 and 14, it says, but if he did not lie in wait for him, in other words, he didn't plan this out and ambush him, but God let him fall into his hand. What does that mean? Well, that's kind of a idiom. It means if God lets it happen. We would call that an act of God type of thing. You know, a guy is on a roofing crew and he knocks a bucket of mastic off the roof with his foot accidentally and it lands on a guy's head and kills him. That's not murder. That's an accident. So it's not classed with murder. It's distinguished from murder. In the place of an accidental death, then there's that asylum that we talked about in chapter 21 where he could go so that he wouldn't be pursued by the blood avenger, as the Bible calls it, the one who is angry at him, maybe a relative or a friend or whatnot. But no sanctuary is to be provided for a murderer, not even the altar itself. And we saw that verse 14. If, however, a man acts presumptuously towards his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. So if you do it on purpose, if it's premeditated, as we call it, then it's capital offense murder. So you get Dano to book him, murder one. Ah, come on. There has to be more people that watch Hawaii Five-O than that. Striking or cursing parents. This is pretty weird, isn't it? You strike your parent, that's a capital offense. I bet they didn't have too many kids talking back to their parents back then. Parental authority is so highly valued in biblical law that striking or cursing a parent is a criminal offense and a capital offense. You know, our culture's taken that and flipped it upside down, haven't we? Now if you strike your child, you're liable to go to jail. Back then, if your kid hit you, that was a capital offense. So I think we have our laws kind of mixed up, but that's just my humble opinion. You know, these two verses, 15 and 17, where it says, he who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And 17, he who curses his father or mother shall surely be put to death. That is the case law coming out of the commandment, the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother. This is the case law associated with that absolute, that moral absolute. You see how that works? And I said that the Ten Commandments form the moral absolute for God's law. Now we're into the case law, the certain circumstances you do this and certain circumstances you do that. But they flow out from the Ten Commandments. Notice again, when I was talking about equality of women, father and mother are mentioned together here. It's not just if you strike your father. If you strike your father or your mother. Again, equality of men and women. Back in an age when it was totally unheard of. Verse 16 talks about kidnapping. He who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. So kidnapping was a capital offense. And if I'm not mistaken, kidnapping is a capital offense in our culture, isn't it? Yeah. I know that under Missouri law, I do know this, that if you see a kidnapping taking place, you are allowed to use lethal force to stop that. Now, that's a tough call. I don't want you to go out and, you know, if you see a guy pushing a girl in a car and you start banging away and blow his head off and then find out later it was her dad trying to get her away from the druggies she was hanging around with, You're not going to live with that very well. But technically, legally, you're not guilty of murder because you're preventing a kidnapping. And kidnapping should be a capital offense. I don't know if it is. It used to be, I know. Kidnapping is not a property offense. No property offense draws a capital punishment. You know, stealing did not draw a capital punishment. This is the theft of a human being. And again, even in our culture, we recognize that. Now we'll stop here since it's time, and we'll pick up next time on bodily injury judgments. This is the ones where you get tapes from lawyers when you get rear-ended in a car accident. Did you ever have that happen? My daughter was rear-ended by a guy in a car one time, and she started getting videos from lawyers wanting to represent her. That's not the case in Jewish law. They could not say, hey, this is my ticket out. I'm going to make a bundle off this. It was back to lex talionis, remember, the judgment fits the crime. We'll see that next week. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for your law, your moral absolutes, which are always moral absolutes, no matter what dispensation we live in. They are expressed differently now in case law than they were by the nation Israel. But moral law is moral law. And Father, we thank you for giving us that law so that we can act according to it, no matter what our civil law says, because our civil law doesn't matter. It's your moral absolutes that matter. In Christ's name, amen.